All right, welcome everybody to a live edition of the Healthy Indoors Show. I'm Bob Krell, founder and publisher of Healthy Indoors Magazine, and we're running some live sessions, continuing our coverage on the COVID-19 pandemic here from healthyindoors.com. Joining me today, we have a panel of some very interesting gentlemen who will bring some interesting perspectives to our discussion, and our topic for today is balancing public health versus the economy. With us today is Kevin Kennedy. Kevin is the program director of the Environmental Health Program at Children's Mercy Kansas City. The program provides patient families, childcare, and schools with resources to assist them in identifying and reducing indoor environmental exposures. They perform research on indoor environmental health issues, focusing on home interventions, exposure assessment, and more recently, a geospatial analysis of health disparities and social detriments of health. He is a certified indoor environmental consultant and previously worked as an environmental and industrial hygiene analytical chemist. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
Joining us again, Dr. David Krause. David is the founder of Healthcare Consulting and Contracting, HC3. He is a certified industrial hygienist and toxicologist with 25 years of experience in public health, occupational hazard assessments, and indoor air quality. He received his doctorate in environmental and occupational health and his master's in public health in toxicology from the University of South Florida. David has expertise in risk assessment, workplace exposures, healthcare facilities, and Legionnaires' disease, combustion products, flame retardants, irritant chemical exposures, indoor air quality, and mold. From 2008 to 2011, David served as the state toxicologist for the Florida Department of Health. He co-authored the 2019 guidelines for the surveillance, investigation, and control of Legionnaires' disease in Florida, and the 2015 AIHA guideline for the recognition, evaluation, and control of Legionella in building water systems. Hi, Dave. Good to have you back. And joining me as my wingman again today and co-moderating will be Joe Medosh. Joe is the health.
Wait. So you can do healthy building scientist, but I want to make sure it's clear today that I'm not actually representing Hayward Score because I'm going to be the jerk. Bob's always a nice guy. So today, this is I will be the advocate of like why we should just send everybody back to work. Everybody gets sick and a bunch of people die and get over this. So that'll be my opinion today. And I'll remind you that it's my opinion for the panel, not my personal opinion. So I will be the advocate as to why staying at home is the worst idea we ever did.
Okay? So you're going to be the protagonist. Okay. I'm good with that. Can I introduce you now, though?
You can't see my sarcasm.
Yeah. We can actually.
Yeah,
see
sure.
It. So can I introduce you? You're just Joe Medosh. Your audio is that well. Anyway, Joe's a healthy building scientist for Hayward Score, and he's the owner of Energy and Environmental Consulting and founder of HHEA, the Healthy Home Environment Association. His diverse background in multiple trades provides a unique understanding of the house as a system. Joe has been evaluating homes for better or worse for 18 plus years and has been a comfort consultant trainer for over 10 years, providing solutions on healthy and energy efficient home performance. And we lost your audio, Joe. Are you working on it? All right. So
I muted myself.
You muted yourself. Okay. That's probably a rarity. All right. So at the top, our topic today is balancing public health and the environment. I'm seeing mixed messages, for me personally, disturbing mixed messages that, you know, it's time to get our nation back to work. It's time to, in my mind, putting the economy somewhat ahead of public health.
Can we do a quick fact check as to things that are happening besides, you know, we've all heard that President Trump wants to do back to work by Easter, but I don't know if anybody caught what Mississippi's governor announced yesterday, that he actually made it illegal for any other smaller community or municipality to say they could initiate their own stay-at-home actions, that is now actually illegal, and that statewide they are go back to work effective immediately. So Florida has a similar cause, but nothing directly from the governor to the state, that staying at home is wrong and no longer constitutional for that state.
Yeah, that's somewhat problematic. And I, my fear is that we're going to see more of that. And hence our topic here today. You know, Dr. Krauss, are we at the apex of this thing? Is it time to start looking at the other side of it? Where are we?
Well, unfortunately, with the lack of testing here in the United States, the lack of involvement as dealing with this as a crisis until just within the past 2 weeks, we're operating in the blind. My intuition and based upon what I've seen and the infectious nature of this, no, we're nowhere near the apex. We're nowhere near the finish line. And I know it's really difficult. It's really hard to implement the few tools and measures we have to control this. But trust me, it's better than the alternative. The alternative is widespread, rampant infection, ongoing, continuous infection across the population. And once it disables our caregivers, the medical staff at the hospitals, the medical and caregiving staff at nursing homes, you may die from a hangnail and gangrene before COVID-19 because there's nobody there to treat you.
So I'm going to play the devil's advocate as we go. So here's my question back to you. So on our panelists or anybody home and in the chat, what year did we have the worst flu epidemic in the last 5 years? Anybody remember? Was it a newsworthy event? 2 years ago, 2017, 18, we had 61,000 people die from a flu epidemic in the U.S. So my goal is to try to be the worst case scenario, is to be like, why is this worse than that? And why were we able to survive that without a news epidemic? So back to you, Dr. Krauss, can you explain what's the difference between that situation and what we're into now?
Well, I think one aspect is that we have ongoing efforts for vaccination. We do have some treatment efforts, modalities for influenza. And while, you know, that many deaths from the flu is fairly well dialed in, we have a pretty good handle on tracking that. We know we are underestimating the number of cases. We're underestimating the impact, and we are looking at a shadow of the real data. The real data is a larger number. It is happening before we think we are seeing it, and we recognize that we don't understand it. We have no meaningful treatments for this, and we have no meaningful vaccines on the horizon, at least within the next 12 to 18 months. So I think the difference really is we are looking into an issue where ongoing community spread is inevitable. And it's on top of the background influenza rate. It's on top of the background bacterial and pneumonias. So yeah, we may be having a bad flu season or we may not. But I think this is a little bit different, and there's so much we don't know. We have to come at this with some humility.
I'm flashing up the Johns Hopkins live worldview of current statistics, and I'm just finding this this chart to be extremely alarming every time I open up my phone and take a look at it. And to me, the lower right hand corner is actually the overall graph showing time on the bottom axis versus the numbers, and you can see, you know, we stayed for almost 60 days down under 100,000 from the first reported case to current, or excuse me, to the first 100,000. You know, it only took another 11 days to get to the second 100,000, and from the second 100,000 to the third to 300,000 took us about 4 more days, and now we're ramping at an alarming rate here. And this is, you have to consider that we really haven't even tested a fraction of a percentage of the world at this point.
And we don't even have a what would be considered a legitimate representative sample. As David said, we're really shooting in the dark here. And even in the countries that are trying to get ahead of this, they really don't have a full grasp of the number in the population that are infected. the typical flu season, if I recall, sadly, about 35 to 40,000 people die a year from the flu. And certainly that's sad. And when the last what was called a potential pandemic certainly elevated that, was maybe double that amount. This is nothing like that. This is nowhere near that low scale. This, as you heard rightfully, we don't have a cure. We are only starting to understand the mechanisms of how this virus works, the systems it attacks. We've been told by the experts that we are likely 12 to 18 months away from a vaccine that might be accelerated because of the incredible work going on worldwide to try to do some rapid testing and accelerate some of the trials and things that might be done. They're even seeking some volunteers in other countries to try to test some of these ideas. The problem is that fundamentally the community doesn't understand some of the basics of public health. There's people who question the need for immunizations for other kinds of healthcare problems. The reason those things have gone down in society is because of routine immunization practice. And right now, we don't have anything that we can battle this disease with other than practical approaches that there is overwhelming history to show they work. Look at the pandemic of 1918, and you've seen the graphs showing the difference in how St. Louis responded and how Philadelphia responded. It's a perfect example of how this stretching out the curve, flattening the curve, has an effect, and it's all based on initially the social distancing, which unfortunately requires our governments to put some enforcement on those of us who are skeptics, because the data is very real about the sheer volume. And I have no doubt, I hope that people have seen the pleas that have come from some of these other countries, from Italy, even from New York. I work for a hospital with many healthcare folks, and I have three brothers that are doctors. People, they are scared. They are overwhelmed with preparation alone. And even though they may have done some preparation, the system they work in is completely overwhelmed. Completely overwhelmed, and they are people dying, waiting in line for treatment. That's a scary situation.
Yeah. So I brought up a slide. Is that visible to you guys? Is that okay? Great. So I want to highlight what Kevin just said as a concept. So this is the 1918 flu pandemic, and it talks about a couple of cities that had this issue, from St. Louis to Philadelphia, and what happened when they waited to close social gatherings. You can see here that's only about a little more than 2 weeks, versus St. Louis, who was listening to what happened to Philadelphia and said, no, within a few days, they shut it down. And you can see the difference of the day of waiting to do, you know, stay in place measures have been a huge amount. So these things are actually well documented. So Kevin's dead on as to just even one day can make a huge difference.
Yeah. And you know, we, as public health officials, have in the past created surveillance programs, mitigation programs, efforts to manage pandemics with less draconian measures. And I liken it to a toolbox. And if you have a toolbox and you have a variety of hammers in that toolbox, you've got a little jeweler's hammer, and then you've got a ball peen hammer and a framing hammer and a mallet and a sledgehammer. Well, the dismantlement of public health surveillance and pandemic preparedness groups at the federal, state, and local levels, we've gotten rid of all those small hammers. And now all we have left is a sledgehammer. And it, you know, it does not do well at driving a 10-penny nail. So this is the only tool we have left, folks. Use it or don't, but it's going to create a lot of damage, ancillary damage to the economy.
So we spoke about this last week. You know, back in 2003 with the SARS outbreak, there at that point, there seemed like there was a large initiative to work on flu vaccines for this type of virus strain, to put more into public health. but we went the opposite direction. You know, if anything, right, would you guys agree that we've gone backwards? We had a 17-year window to prepare for this, mm-hmm. and we haven't.
No, we prepared for it, and then we dismantled it.
Yeah,
we
built right. it. That's right.
We spent the money, and it's gone.
There has been capacity that was there at one point. There have been publications, projections. I mean, the value of epidemiologic research and looking back at history, looking at the history that Joe showed in that graph, is understanding behavior patterns and what worked and didn't work with previous pandemics and using that to prepare ourselves for the future. And we actually did that. There were detailed analyses. I highly recommend you read the works of Lori Garrett, a famous Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, public health journalist, who had a book she won a Pulitzer Prize for in 1995, talking about the next pandemic and what's going to happen. She had a book in, I think it was 2005 or 6, that warned us we're not ready, that the public health system's being dismantled and we are not ready for what's coming. And now she works, does articles for Foreign Policy magazine, and it's all coming true as has been described. That capacity isn't there. And I think David put it very well. We're left with a sledgehammer. We had tremendous capacity. People don't realize the value of their local public health agency and how much that agency is paying attention to disease outbreaks, foodborne outbreaks, all sorts of techniques and tools they use for surveillance of potential impacts on the community. That's their job. And then the other part of that is disaster response and recovery, which they serve a vital role in. But there's been this strange stepping away from the recognition, and the state I live in is equally guilty of this, having significantly defunded all of their local public health agencies. So we're left with a lack of people with training, knowledge, and capacity to know how to do certain things. That makes those communities dependent on the state and whatever resources they've established. And fortunately, many states still have good scientists that work for them. But what the community is left doing is, as David described, it's got to be this full force. We can ask people to appoint to practice the social distancing, but we have to do things that kind of coerces, kind of forces them to do these things.
The thing is, though, we haven't actually even implemented the full force, right? We haven't had a nationwide lockdown.
Yeah, right.
We haven't done that.
David said it right.
I'm reading somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of the country still isn't even...
There's a toolbox. All public health, you know, on a national, federal level, and David certainly sounds like he has the experience. He could probably speak to it better than I do. But there are stages within their practice as these outbreaks occur, as these pandemics occur. There's investigation and surveillance and other things that help them understand what actions to take. What are the next steps going to be? That's why the testing would have been incredibly valuable. Had we started doing that testing, if we developed a test when we knew, if we had started testing way back in the fall of 2019, we would have been able to stage in certain communities the social distancing. We would have been able to identify which people were highest at risk and which places to isolate, which types of businesses to maybe close. It could have been more strategic. That's why we need the sledgehammer now. And unfortunately, that math is scary in that it's telling us, we can see now when the big wave is going to hit particular communities. My hospital is full bore in preparation, even though Kansas City hasn't hit the start of that apex. We know it's coming.
Well, and the other problem is, and I think people negate this fact, you know, we're discussing the total hospital beds, you know, we have in the U.S. We have under 1 million total hospital beds in the entire country, in the United States, which puts us at somewhere around 2.8 beds per 1,000. You know, Germany has 8 beds per 1,000. South Korea has 12 beds per 1,000. So before this even started, we were woefully underprepared to be able to handle, you know, an increase in the census. What are the healthcare facilities? Kevin, your hospital, what's your census typically there, percentage-wise? It's usually like 90%?
No, a little less than that. And it depends on the season. But generally, it's in that 70 to 80% capacity. But that's a good point. Those beds are already taken up. There are 100,000 ICUs in the United States. Those are usually taken up.
It's not a business model. It's not a business model that any hospital would do, but that's why state and federal funds required hospitals to create stockpiles of N95s, certain drugs, certain capacities. When they stop funding that, those products have an expiration date. Once they're expired, they started using them up or discarding them, and nobody made them or funded them to install it. The cost of that funding will be a rounding error in the total cost to our impact, our economy that we're going to look at.
But did we even have stockpiles that that would approach the numbers we would need for a pandemic of this scale? You know, I mean,
we had stockpiles that would have that would have been in the hands of the health professionals, and they would have given us sufficient time to ramp up manufacturing, given the surveillance was operational. Right. So yeah, we would have. It would not have been pretty. It would not have been easy, but it would have been doable. And now we're looking back at that situation and wish we were there.
Yeah. And the death rate ultimately would be lower. You'd still have to do some social distancing. It could have been a targeted social distancing. You could have just affected the whole system. And the problem is that the whole healthcare system switched to an on-time inventory system, which a lot of business, you know, most of business has switched to. And that just isn't the right way to do it. That just is not the right way, as David rightly said. You got to plan for the bad days, the disasters, et cetera. And maybe it's a matter of having regional capacity. That's another approach. But clearly, this needs to be reorganized and rethought.
But, you know, Bob, I think one of the things we need to think about here is that maybe this is just a preview of what we need to recognize as the new normal. We recognize that the, antibiotic-resistant bacteria and the ability to become resistant, is that day is approaching. We're not sure when it'll get here. But it's happening faster and faster with many commonplace organisms. You know, prior to 1940s, the leading cause of death in most people was infections. Okay, it wasn't cancer, it wasn't heart disease. You died of an infection, either at birth or anywhere along the entire spectrum. And so part of this is possibly our perception. You know, it was commonplace that families had a dozen kids so that three or four would make it into the next generation. We may be peering into that with a viral disease, but if we don't get a handle on this and we don't recognize that we cannot rely upon treating you once you're sick in order to save us from that, then this may become our new reality, and the death rates may return closer to, you know, 1918, 1920, 1930s from bacterial and viral infections.
So I'm going to be the counterpoint again for a moment. So as a side note, if anybody wants to go see an amazing video, it's called A Letter from COVID-19. And it's a phenomenal, simple video that talks about how much this is impacting us and what it's doing. And maybe it's a reset button and then stops and looks at our entire ecosystem as it is. It kind of is a major shocker as to what really is going on. In fact, maybe people miss the news that down in the Amazon rainforest, they consider it to be beyond the point of return in terms of the amount of area that's being burned. So there's a lot of stuff that this isn't a major situation worldwide, but there are other worldwide epidemics. The one I have up on the screen is about deaths by age group. And notice that the top things are by a significant number, you know, major cardiovascular disease, heart disease, and a variety of other stuff that's based upon, you know, why are we killing ourselves with our diet? I'm not trying to distract from what we're talking about, but the point is that you're right, that there are a variety of things that are now in terms of how we are addressing our reality. So, my one question back to the panel, because I want to try and see. So we can't go back. Here's where we are today. If you were the man in charge of all money and funding for the U.S., all right, including what we should do economically with our industry, what would give me two things you would say, you know what, Wright should do this. So Kevin, I'll come back to you. What are the two things you think us as a country should say, you know what, from right now, that's what we should be doing?
I would just reinforce what we've already touched upon. Two things. One, significant more funding to public health, because I think people are starting to recognize, I hope they are recognizing the value of their local public health agencies and providing them the capacity, which means some training, some hiring of staff at a state and local level. Then the other part is what we've also talked about, and that is building up that back capacity of critical supplies. Because really the other parts of this is climate change and climate disruption is going to lead to more of these kinds of disease outbreaks. That's going to lead to more disasters that we need to respond and recover to. All of these things require a robust, resilient healthcare system that has the storehouse and the capacity. So it isn't just about saving up for the next pandemic. It's just being practical as a society in setting ourselves up with what we know is effective public health and effective practice for managing these kind of major outbreaks. And those are the two I'd focus on.
Well, I mean, clearly this virus, this isn't the only thing that we're going to face in 2020. I mean, this is horrific and all that, but as we spoke about last week, guys, you know, the climate-related things that are happening, the, you know, the accelerated hurricanes, wildfires, all these other things, all of our normal other medical issues that we face, none of that's just going to take a break because we suddenly have a virus to contend with. And we've never, as a country, to my knowledge, had to deal with really climate-driven extreme weather occurrences, extreme outdoor environmental occurrences, simultaneously with a pandemic. This is not a good situation.
Well, here's an example, Bob. How many people know there was a magnitude 5.4 earthquake right outside of Zagreb, Croatia today? It's barely cresting the news. And, you know, not only is our communication and news, our news agencies limited in being able to cover that, but on any average day, that would be headline news.
There was also a 7.8 Richter scale earthquake in the Pacific that was sending a tsunami towards Hawaii over the last couple of days.
Yeah. So those disasters we can count on. One of the few guarantees in life. You're going to continue in having those disasters. Going back to the question.
Dr. Krause, what are your
to the question of how would you fund it or what would you do with the monies? One, it's not just throwing money at the current health department, CDC, FEMA, you have to implement leadership. You have to implement qualified individuals. There has been a diminution of the brain trust, for lack of a better word, the professionals who had been at health departments for decades, who had come up through the counties and were and leaders in you know, at bureaus and divisions where the rubber meets the road at every state and county health department. Those folks are gone, retired, run out. And often I hate to say it, I'm the biggest advocate and the biggest critic of public health agencies. Without knowledgeable professionals in place who have some experience, some institutional knowledge, you throw money at it right now, you might as well flush it down the toilet. I don't have confidence in the guidance, in their ability to communicate, in their ability to make sound decisions, because I keep seeing bad decisions coming out of them all the time. And it's obvious that our leadership, our executive offices at the governor, at the executive office of the governor in various states, as well as the White House, they're not listening to them. If good guidance is coming from health, public health, our politicians aren't listening to them. And so you might as well not even have them there. So there has to be a reestablishment of leadership, knowledge, expertise. And unfortunately, that's going to take some time.
See, but that said, here's where we are today. Here it is Thursday, the 26th of March. And what, you know, what you're suggesting, what Kevin's suggesting, I totally wholeheartedly agree with that. But, you know, what, where we are right now, you know, all the people, you know, in this country and worldwide, we can't fix the broken systems overnight. And I think that's a discussion that, you know, that it should be the forward thinking mindset and the proactive mindset for the future. But we're right in crisis mode right now. You know, the house is on fire.
Yeah.
Bob, what's the two things you would do if you were the man to make the decisions? Bob, you're up.
Yeah. I mean, I think first and foremost, I would defer to the people that are the experts, the medical experts, and the epidemiologists, the public health sector. I mean, honestly, we have a wealth of knowledge globally of how to handle this type of a situation. And we need to defer to that expertise and actually start utilizing those people, in my mind, you know, it's first and foremost. So the decisions, I understand that economics are a factor. Sure, they're a factor. But you know what? You know, it's really bad for business and bad for economy, a bunch of dead people. And I'm just going to be really blatant about this. We're not going to solve this situation, you know, it's simply based on, well, this is inconvenient for us at this time.
Yeah, I'll just debate you here for a second, Bob. Sure. While epidemiologists are often portrayed as being the knowledge bearers, as a toxicologist, often in a wash of epidemiologists at the health department, as I said, you couldn't swing a dead cat without hitting an epidemiologist around there. Their main job is to count the bodies. They do not have the training, the background, the experience, the expertise in understanding the mechanisms, in looking forward and giving advice on how do you do this. They can certainly look back at history as anybody could and say, well, they did that, well, let's do it again. But let's not over endow them with knowledge and wisdom. They're literally, their job is count the pile of bodies and give you a statistical analysis of how they think it might have happened, but they
need analysis
to have that detailed information.
You know, and really, the second part of your question, Joe, is what were the two things I would do? The second thing I would do is I would be, you know, using that Defense Authorization Act immediately. I mean, it should have happened months ago, but you know, yes. You know what the second best time to start acting properly is? Now. Okay. You know, we should have done it earlier, but we can't do it earlier. We don't have a time machine. So we need to fully ramp up all capacity to be able to manufacture N95 masks, ventilators, and all other peripheral personal protective.
Well, wait a minute, Bob. CDC said masks really don't help that much.
Okay. We'll go there in a second. But I think we absolutely, you know, there needs, in my opinion, I would totally implement a national quarantine. You know, and until such time as we can actually find out where the hotspots are. I mean, it's a no-brainer that New York City and you know, much of my state are, you know, on fire effectively. But my fear is that this is just, we're just a few weeks ahead of what you're going to see, and perhaps Chicago and other major markets. You know, we're just early on the curve. I think this could be just a thing that's going to recur. So to that question, actually, I'm going to take a question, an audience question here. So Lou Harriman asks, David and Kevin, masks, should we all be wearing them? Isn't the guidance not to bother with masks only because we need them to save them for healthcare workers? But as the shortages ease, doesn't the experience of China and Korea suggest that we all use them? And I think, let me preface this by saying, let's delineate the difference between masks, surgical masks, right, medical masks, and respirators. You know, and unfortunately, people look at an N95 respirator, which looks like a mask, but, you know, I think there's this confusion. So take it away, gentlemen. David, I'll let you take a first jump on that. Should we be using them, or should we be saving them?
Of course. If you do everything in this hierarchy of approach that we do in industrial hygiene, can you administratively stop the exposure? Can you do it with a substitution? Then you look at engineering controls, and then you look at PPE. So, you know, that's what we've essentially done here. We don't have enough PPE to go around and say, everyone put on a N95 and then, you know, take some other measures. We've gone to that administrative section of go home, social distancing, which still people aren't really doing yet. And one thing I've got to say about that, getting on the path to recovery is like getting on a ferry boat. And that boat is not leaving until the last person's on board. And this trickle effect of communities and states holding off and refusing to put in more restrictive measures is keeping that ferry from leaving. We cannot anticipate things to start getting significantly better across this country until everyone's singing the same tune.
Which means Kevin, are we on the path to recovery yet?
Well, first, let me just reinforce what David was saying. It is taking a practical approach. The problem is you have to think about it from the public health and risk communication perspective. And if the CDC goes out and says everybody should have a mask, then there's this mask rush to the hospital, to the stores, which there already was a little bit of. So they're trying to get people to take a reasonable approach. There are times when, yes, the PPE is needed, but if you're doing the other things that have been prescribed, the social distancing, then it minimizes the need for the additional PPE. But you still have to be very conscious of who you may or may not have come in contact with and where you've gone, because we know that the virus can sit on surfaces for, I think the last I heard was a 3 hours at one point. So, and then we don't know who actually has it because we're not testing, and we don't know where those people have gone. So either way, the social distancing is the best approach. But if it is a person who in fact has been infected, and unfortunately, even in my own family, I've got a couple of contacts. Some of my kids have had some of their friends and folks who have actually tested positive and have been forced into self-isolation. Those are the times when the PPE is critical, and the hand washing, hand sanitizing, hand washing, several steps. If you read through any of the guidance, it's just doffing to help someone and or donning and doffing and helping someone. There are multiple stages of decon and sanitization. So that's really where the focus of using PPE needs to be. It isn't required for all activities if people are smart about the activities that they take.
There's a big if.
Yeah. No, that's a challenge.
We haven't communicated. Public health officials have not effectively communicated the dangers, the risks, the hazards. They certainly not provided any training to people. They've not provided any guidance on how do you don and doff a N95 properly for the general public. It has been handled in a haphazard manner, and people are not smart about this right
now. No, that's right. You know? That's the other part of it. And that's probably another reason why they're saying, because people have no real sense of proper fitting, and most of us on the call looks like we're not even prepared to be properly wearing one. you're better off getting people to focus on some of the other issues instead of what worrying about whether they have a proper N95 mask, what that is, or whatever.
Yeah, and no, but here's my concern with that. It's the only option we have. We can talk theoretically, would a mask be good? Go buy one right now. Good luck.
Yeah.
An N95, go find an Elastomeric half-face respirator, you know, at Harbor Freight or at Home Depot, where most people would be able to obtain these. You can't find them. So that's a pipe dream. The only option we have is administrative and engineering controls.
Yeah, I believe.
All right, so I'm going to.
Let me say one thing. Harbor Freight actually donated all of their PPE to the local hospital near the individual satellite stores across the country. So that was pretty amazing.
I appreciate that.
So we will get back into social less distancing very soon because of the mentality that's out there, and just people think that it suddenly is safer to do that. So I want to put a scenario in front of you and you guys tell me, you know, that's crazy or anything is better than nothing. So we do go back to a little more less distance or getting closer to people in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, even a month. You still are not going to be able to, let's talk about anything that actually interrupts your sneezing, coughing, breathing on somebody close to you or somebody else sneezing and you end up inhaling that. So my question to you is, even as a surgical mask, a bandana, is there anything that actually says, you know what, it is better than nothing to have something on your face that keeps you from coughing on your neighbor or your neighbor coughing on you? Anybody?
In general,
Dr. yes. Dr. Krause?
Yes. In general, yes. We do know that.
I know you're not prescribing that. So if you have a choice, you yes. Okay.
Yeah.
I know you're not prescribing that. You should have a good mask that is fitted. Right. Okay.
Qualitatively, though, you know, what percentage difference does it make? I would say that that's we know we don't have many studies that demonstrate that.
Nope.
On population wise, you know, a 95% efficient mask, is that enough to truly protect you, assuming at least 5% of those respirable aerosols are still going to make their way through? That may still be an infectious dose. We don't have data on this.
No, we don't know.
And so the best you can do is offer good general advice. Do no harm is the first thing. But I think telling people out of one side of your mouth, masks don't do you much good. And then in the next sentence saying we need to save those masks for healthcare providers totally destroys your credibility.
And there are a couple of different aspects of this discussion right here too. First of all, delineating between masks and respirators, right? An N95 respirator, and again, I'll bring a graphic up, you know, again, of what one of those looks like. So an N95 respirator it looks like a paper mask, but it's not. It's a filtered fitted mask that goes around your face. This, again, you're saying it's, you know, 95% efficient, but again, at larger particle sizes, it's quite a bit more efficient versus a surgical mask or just some sort of a dust mask. The two different purposes, right? A respirator, an N95 or a higher end full face respirator, any of those respirators, they're designed to protect the wearer from exposure. A surgical mask, on the other hand, is designed to stop you from spewing stuff out of your body onto you, you know, in the surgical theater, right? So the surgeon doesn't spew his mucus droplets down into the open wound. So it's two different mindsets. So I think the thing of the surgical mask and even like the bandana, as Joe said, right, that's going to at least limit your velocity of the droplets you're spewing out of your mouth. Is it going to be totally effective? No, but it's certainly, just knowing aerodynamics, it's got to slow things down. If you have something over your face, you're not going to spread it as far, right? Is that true?
Yes. If you're stopping the aerosol and the dispersion of the aerosol, if you can minimize you're minimizing the potential for you to project something.
Correct.
It still doesn't, of course, protect you from something that might be in the air. But as you said, with shortages, there are lots of efforts to make your own, and specifications have been developed for make your own because of the chronic shortages. It's a fail-safe. It's better than nothing, and it's better than, say, selecting a surgical mask as opposed to something that is more tightly fitted. But we're going to do the best with what's available, unfortunately.
So we're at the 3/4 point here of our time. We've got about 15 minutes left. What can we direct the general public to do, you know, with the knowledge that we have today? You know, here we are. It's Thursday, the 26th of March. We're seeing the ramp on that curve just going vertical as far as the global recordings of the actual confirmed cases internationally. New York State, you know, is on a crazy ramp up, right? So we're at approaching almost 40,000 confirmed cases in New York State now.
Bob, I think one of the things we have to realize and we have to take with a big grain of salt are the confirmed case numbers. Is that a number that we can hang your hat on?
No.
No, we can't.
No.
So I think really it's going to be on the fatalities, on the number, on the excess number of deaths. Those you cannot play with in the, you know, in the data manipulation, the data massaging. What did you deem this death to be? Because they're not doing postmortems on people who died of pneumonia. They're saying it was probably COVID-19, take them to the morgue. That is the extent that they were worried about trying to keep the living alive. But my concern is that the mindset of we can fix this by not communicating, by not testing, by not identifying things, that is going to be a very attractive low-hanging fruit to some people who really aren't science-oriented to begin with. I've seen it in public health before. I've seen policymakers and politicians have that conversation. This has got to stop. How do we stop it? Stop documenting the cases, stop reporting the cases. And we as the public need to be conscious that that is a unfortunate and sad human nature, that in order to make this stop, stop counting the cases. The one thing you can't stop counting are the number of deaths. And I think that's intuitively making all of us more scared than the numbers should make us right now. You're right. 40,000 cases. What's the big deal? Obviously, something's amiss. There's a disconnect. You don't see overwhelming of hospital systems because of the flu on a regular basis.
Yeah, so, it's not so much the specific number as it is the trends.
Yes. Right.
Clearly, there's an explosion in the trend, and it's an upward explosion. And we—it's all those of us who have any sense of the numbers. That's why, you know, the sad thing is, 40% of the U.S. population can't do basic math. They need visualizations like this that you're showing us now. They need to see those maps. They need to see that trend line. People don't have a full grasp of how to interpret these things.
I'd say probably a number of politicians and policymakers can't do that
right.
math.
That's exactly right. Concern, Bob, is that there is an explosion of stuff on social media that are anecdotal things, that are remedies, that are strange ideas that people have for how to deal with it. I would strongly advocate that if you're going to get information and you want to get accurate information, start with the CDC and start with World Health Organization. Look at the information that they have available. And now, if you look at the CDC site, there is a whole host of educational resources, infographics, a lot of resources have been built up. World Health Organization has a Mythbusters section. You know, what are the myths about COVID-19? You can look at those. I would highly advocate people look for those sources first, and then start to look at some of the other resources that you know have some evidence behind them.
Well, you know, there's for the average listener out there, one day we're going to have to go back to work, okay? And COVID-19 will not be ended by them. What do you do to protect yourself in that meantime? Right now, most building owners, facility operators, employers who contact me, they say, we've got to report one of our employees was possibly exposed to someone who may have been blah, blah, blah. And they want to go decon the facility. And, you know, we first do a reality check. Yes, that person, you know that information now. You should be assuming you get infected people walking into your building every day. What can you do about that unseen hazard that happened 2 weeks ago and is happening today? And I think we need to get away from the idea that you're going to go in and you're going to nuke the building. You're going to decon everything. And because we just don't even have the tools to tell if that's even being effective. I think we need to really guide people back into a more ongoing, every day, throughout the day, disinfect, cleaning and disinfecting. We shouldn't just say disinfect. Clean and disinfect high-touch surfaces. Clean and disinfect the main walkway and areas. Everybody clean and disinfect. It's got to be integrated into your daily activities, both the employees, the staff, and enhance cleaning and disinfection throughout the facility. that's the only thing that's going to be helpful. Going in and fogging a place with some biocide 3 weeks after somebody may have been there is nonsense.
Well, I mean, the latency period with this COVID-19 is a whole different ballgame too. You know, the comparisons to flu, you know, flu, what the latency, you're asymptomatic for maybe a day or two, and then you're symptomatic, you know, so you have a pretty good idea of if you're contagious, you know, with the flu, pretty much at the onset of the disease, where this, what the latency period is, what, 12, 14 days? You know, potentially. So you could be
100% of the time.
Yeah, because we don't even know. We don't even know the percentage of asymptomatic people out there. That's the other thing. We don't even know. So there, right. I mean, there was an interesting comment. It's interesting comment. Trevor Noah from Daily Show posted something yesterday that I thought was amazing. He's saying how people are not recognizing the threat of this in many areas of this country, especially because they don't see it. It's an unseen problem, right? And what he said is like, you know, but like, you know, or there's six cases in your community. Well, that doesn't sound so bad, you know, but what if you were to think of it in terms of there were six zombies in your community? Would you be wanting to run out on the street and go back to work if there were six zombies walking the streets at night in your town? Probably not. You know, and we got to start looking at it, you know, framing it in a mindset maybe that people can grasp, I think.
Well, I think we're battling back against a lot of misinformation that was put out at the highest levels that to diminish the threat, the risk, and the potential adverse effects. So, you know, it's hard to uninform.
Wait, to clarify, it wasn't the risk that they were worried about. They were worried about the risk of the economy, and this is an election year, so their priorities were quite skewed as to, don't let those people off that boat because my numbers are going to go up. That was a direct statement. So I think the priority as to what's really our focus has been skewed. And I think it's actually clear as to what's coming out of their mouth as to what's the priority versus what should be the priority. So I'm hoping that people really take this into heart as to that many of them are kind of being sacrificed. That's right. Being sacrificed. That's right. Yeah. So it is a priority forever, but we just kind of lost path as to, is it your retirement that's there? Yeah.
Go back to that last graphic you showed.
You want me to put up the last slide?
Yeah. That last slide, important information there to look at. One, as I understand, standard, one person on average right now is infecting 2.5 other people. So this spreads through the community rapidly. It's highly contagious. Then the bottom there, the thing that people don't understand is the potential of this case fatality rate. CDC, I think it was last year or the year before, did a practice of a pandemic and ran through a whole projection what they expected for the next pandemic. And that was a 1% case fatality rate, I think. And that was worldwide, looking at just around 65 million to 70 million deaths. We're looking at a potential 3.4 case fatality rate. That's 3 to 4 times that value worldwide. And I don't think people understand the number of people who could potentially die from this. It isn't just about the elderly or the sick or it's everybody. And we're starting to see more and more fatalities the younger age population. And that's
Kevin,
just going to continue.
It's not just the fatalities.
Yeah, that's right.
Complications caused
right.
by going onto a ventilator are huge. And life altering. And
yeah, long term, that's right.
Years, the you know, talking about the treatment not being worse than the problem, you know, the necessary thing to keep a lot of these people alive that we're all fighting over at this point of ventilators themselves are you know, have unintended consequences.
Permanent scarring. There's lots of problems. Yeah.
Well, look at the recovery period too. People recover from the flu an awful lot quicker than they're going to recover from this disease.
Yeah. Yeah,
this is a long-term illness. I want to get this.
The false equivalent.
Wait, I want to get one more question to end you guys.
Flu is crazy.
Yeah. So the issue is that I perceive we're going to have a false reality of like, oh, things are okay now come this summer. That's a common theme that comes out. Oh, yeah, as soon as it gets warm, this will fade away. Dr. Fushi, might put it correctly, probably not, described, which I've been preaching for a while, is that this may settle in the summer, you know, and the sunlight and other things will have some great benefits. But can you both elaborate briefly on what do you possibly predict, especially upon previous situations, what will happen in the fall when people go back to their indoor area? We go back to this flu season, which this is now a new flu that we will live with forever. Right? So there's multiple flus, dozens of different types of flus. So now COVID will just be, oh, you have the COVID flu 2 years from now. So can you guys talk about what your concerns about what happens when we come into the fall and this actually outbreaks again?
So let me provide a little bit of history then. The pandemic of 1918 actually had three waves. And the first wave, which was strongly associated with infection and passed on between soldiers, the first wave was actually the mildest of the three. The second wave was greater, and the third wave was not quite as significant as the second. But that third wave was in 1919. So you are absolutely right that there's both the seasonal part, and then one worry of people looking worldwide is that if the more it gets into the southern hemisphere, the greater the likelihood of it coming back to our hemisphere next year with a greater impact on all the northern hemisphere countries. And unfortunately, that seems to be the pattern already.
This is not one and done. I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, it's not going to magically disappear as weather gets warmer. I mean, you may see a ramp of the curve, clearly, right? I mean, if it follows any other previous viral type, pandemics, that's what it'll do. But it'll be back, I believe, with a vengeance. We're a long ways out from a vaccine and real treatment, right?
Yeah, every year plus. A forever thing. I don't see that being the situation. We're likely to develop some inherent immunity as more and more of the population is exposed and recovers from it. It's likely we'll develop a vaccine that will have some effectiveness. But you know, that all depends upon the bug. If the virus does mutate sufficiently, as the influenza does, then we may see a different version. You know, how we see different strains of the flu come out each year. And they're going to be, predicting and trying to develop and fine tune vaccines for that. So, yeah, this will probably get folded in with similar issues, but I think we'll get a handle on it in the future. But I think 3.3 million unemployment claims last month. I think that the devastation that this is going to do to our public health system, that will last a lot longer than the COVID-19.
So final thoughts. I mean, we've been discussing, you know, really from the side of the public health side, that this is a real public health threat. I mean, it's evolving into a much worse threat than maybe some people made it out to be. Is it justified taking very strenuous efforts here to try to clamp this down, even at the cost of the economy? Let's go around the horn and see what you guys, kind of closing thoughts. I mean, what's our best course of action? What do we do? I mean, what should we be doing? Kevin, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, Kevin, the question is spike it out or slow curve?
Right.
Well, fundamentally, I'm going to be a huge advocate for the social distancing and flattening the curve. That is what every citizen can do. The problem is getting every citizen to do that. So anybody listening, I would advocate that you gather materials from legitimate sites. These guys have put up some great resources. Go to the CDC or WHO and then put up on your social media, link people to social media, advocate for why these things are important, and do as much as you can to get your community or regional communities to practice some of the practical things here immediately. That I think is the first step and the most important thing to do.
David?
Rebuild the public health system. What we have now is a shadow of what it used to be, both internally and externally. They don't have the credibility. They don't have the knowledge base. They don't have the institutional knowledge. They don't have the resources. They need to be rebuilt. And I think we need to pound home and bring home to every policymaker and every person across this country that public health is financial health. If you do not have a fundamental cornerstone that ensures that the health and safety of your population, you will not have a good financial status. People don't go to vacation or to build a community or to build a business where you don't have good public health resources. And we have to build into that. We have to rebuild that infrastructure. People may think it's there, but it's a mere shell of what it used to be.
Joe.
I'm going to go on a sidetrack briefly. So
nothing new there.
One of the things that clearly the focus, but oh, am I here? Come on. So my sidetrack is that right now, you know, more people are spending up to 40 to 50% more time in their house. And this could impact their immune system. This is actually making them more vulnerable. The things that they're susceptible to are now actually embracing them. They're not able to get away from their home. Their home is not able to settle. So it's not as severe as what's happening with the coronavirus, but it is actually going to, I think, impact all us in general. And I think trying to talk about the economy is that I think when we get out of this, people are going to be more thinking about how their home is actually a safe environment for themselves and family and a variety of stuff from ventilation to filtration, and other stuff that are just basic things to make us more combative to what is actually outside our doors and how we go back to work and knowing that when I come home, I actually have a place that actually allows my immune system to recover. So we do have some great resource, not your typical stuff on HeywardScore.com. So go there and look for that kind of stuff. But we do think that we could be impacting our healthcare system by staying at home for 24 hours a day with your family, all jumping around, going not just mentally crazy, but the burden that actually will come upon us to then when we come back out, being realized that we kind of really stressed our immune system out in more of exposure to what could happen afterwards. Bob, you're up.
Sure. Well, here's the thing. I would say it's still a stay tuned status, but I mean, I'm really concerned of anybody minimizing what this is, because the numbers maybe don't look that bad, because maybe the numbers aren't the same death toll that we would see in an annual normal year to the flu. But what we're seeing that's alarming, you know, like Kevin, all of you panelists pointed out, is that there's an alarming incidence of the infection rate with this, the latency, so you don't know who's carrying it, and then you know just the mortality rate. It's significantly higher than the flu. Maybe, you know, the reason that we have many more people dying per year of the flu typically than we have seen so far with COVID-19 is because many more people get the flu and recover from it. I think that's right. That's the point that we need to make. And this is not the case. I mean, this disease has a pretty high incidence rate. So I think we can't really be minimizing this. And I think it's really a disservice at any community. That's pretty scary. So we're on the close-up point here. I just wanted to make mention of the fact that at healthyindoors.com, that's our website for the magazine and our publication. It's at healthyindoors.com. All digital issues of the magazine reside there. Our publication, Healthy Indoors Magazine, comes out in a digital form every month. It is free to everyone worldwide, so it's a resource you should look at. The webpage, the .com site, also offers a lot of informational resources and a lot of areas that you can research things beyond COVID-19. COVID-19 is our headline right now, obviously, because it is in the forefront of everybody's mind. But as Joe, our panelists did, all the other indoor environmental issues that we deal with globally, regionally, and even down to our own home, they aren't going away for this virus. All those other causal agents are still out there. So, it's important that you don't forget about everything else. Just, you know, this, we're fighting the crisis, but there's a lot of other indoor environmental impacts on your health. And certainly you're spending a lot of time indoors right now. And we're spending a lot of time at home. Most people are spending more time at home than they ever have. So to that end, the March edition, digital edition of Healthy Indoors we'll make sure that that's all available to all of you out there. We also will be continuing a weekly Healthy Indoor Show, which is new for us. We're doing it monthly before, but now we will be on a weekly basis. For the foreseeable future, we'll be at every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time now through the summer. And we'll hope that you will continue to join us here, and we'll try to be a good source for cutting edge information. And again, we'll be covering the COVID COVID stories and the COVID information because that's in the forefront of our minds. But also, mind you, that we'll be taking a look at a lot of other supplemental indoor environmental issues that we just can't forget about. Any closing thoughts, gentlemen?
So one of the ones which, I'm going to propose one, so this will be a surprise to Bob, but I want to try and come back next week or the week after about keep the construction trade alive. Do need to get back into homes in a month or less, or why we cannot build a building outside right now. So I would like to address the construction side and how that can boost the economy for things that we could be doing that we've decided to shut down. So that's one of my proposals to Bob, that we'll try and find some great panelists to figure out what is it if a month from now and you have to go to somebody's house to address their mold issue or their leaky pipe, here's what you need to know and what you need to inform your.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to thank all our panelists, Dr. David Krause, Kevin Kennedy, and Joe Wingman for today. I know we're all up to here dealing with all the aspects of what's going on because we're all in crisis mode in the indoor environmental community. But very helpful, and I think this will be some valuable information for the general public. So for Healthy Indoors Magazine and the Healthy Indoors Show, I'm Bob Krell, and we will see you next week, Thursday, 1 to 2 p.m. here on healthyindoors.com.